This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Vice President Kamala Harris is in Guatemala. Her mission, to speak with leaders about what's driving migration to the U.S., including government corruption in Central America.
That means, you know, that there's no money for education, you know, building a better healthcare system.
Also today, looking for the origins of the pandemic, author Lawrence Wright revisits previous disease outbreaks.
SARS leaked out of labs in China on four separate occasions. So the idea that a lab leak might happen, I think, is totally plausible.
And a Colombian coffee export with a kick, as in kick-starting a conversation about immigration reform.
So many conversations are had over cups of coffee, and why not something as important as this one?
I'm Marco Werman. Those stories and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. It is good to be with you this Monday. Vice President Kamala Harris is in Guatemala today. If the start of her trip is any sign, yesterday Air Force Two had to turn back after takeoff for a safety check, the assignment is going to be a challenge. This is Harris's first foreign trip, a mission President Joe Biden gave her: find ways to reduce migration to the U.S. by improving conditions in Central America. One of the big challenges in the region is how ineffective governments there have been at solving the simple grinding problems of daily life in their countries. Speaking from Guatemala City today, Harris said she and Guatemalan President Alejandro Giammattei talked about a key issue, corruption.
On the issue of corruption, the conversation that I had with President Giammattei today was very frank and very candid, and I think this is a quality that he and I appreciate in each other.
Following all of this is Adriana Beltran with the watchdog group, the Washington Office on Latin America. She said Harris is right to focus on corruption.
And unfortunately, over the last several years, what you've seen across the region, including Guatemala, has been a backlash against anti-corruption, anti-impunity efforts, and increasingly actions by corrupt elites to undermine democracy and the rule of law.
So as long as we're on the subject, explain in simple terms how corruption actually reduces the impact of USAID to Central America.
When we talk about corruption in Guatemala and Central America, we're not talking about a few bad apples, a few corrupt government officials that accept bribes. But what we're talking about is systems that have been put in place where corrupt elites, and in the case of Guatemala, increasingly tied to criminal groups, have taken hold of government institutions and have used their positions of power to enrich themselves by embezzling millions of public funds at the expense of the majority of the population. You know, regionally, you're talking about around $13 billion that I believe is lost a year to corruption. That means, you know, that there's no money for education, you know, building a better healthcare system, infrastructure. It impacts the ability of these governments to respond to natural disasters or climate change. It impacts security. It impacts every aspect of daily life.
Mm. And is that $13 billion just for Guatemala or all three countries of the Northern Triangle?
That's regionally for Central America.
So we hear about the three countries of the Northern Triangle, Guatemala, El Salvador, and Honduras. The people from those countries are most likely to try to enter the U.S. But Vice President Harris is visiting only Guatemala. Why is that?
The challenges in Central America are immense right now. One, relations between the Biden administration and the Bukele government in El Salvador are very tense. This is a government in El Salvador that has repeatedly taken steps to attack the rule of law, to concentrate power in the hands of the executive and dismantle any real system of check and balance. In the case of Honduras, you know, over the last year or so, the U.S. Department of Justice has been investigated and convicted the president's brother for drug trafficking.
So, Adriana, it sounds like basically you're saying Guatemala may be corrupt, but it's the most likely government where Vice President Harris could get some traction and cooperation.
I think they started with Guatemala by default, not by design. Mm. But I would say that if corruption and the rule of law is not front and center in discussions between the U.S. government and the Guatemalan government, the trip could do more damage than good. And I say this because since 2019, when the UN-led commission to tackle corruption was dismantled by the previous administration in Guatemala, you've seen a consistent effort and actions by the government and by corrupt political and economic elites to dismantle the advances that had been made in the anti-corruption effort.
How then can Vice President Harris hope to kind of help build a model with Guatemala that might show the way forward in stemming migration?
Unfortunately, I think the U.S., different administrations have often turned their attention to the region whenever they perceive a crisis, and then attention wanes and shifts elsewhere. These are long-term challenges. These are deep structural challenges that are going to require a long-term sustainable approach. And so, you know, if the administration is committed to helping these societies address these structural challenges, then we need to commit for the long haul.
Adriana Beltran is with the Washington Office on Latin America. She's been telling us about the challenges Vice President Harris and the White House face on Harris's first foreign policy trip to Central America. Adriana, thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
Sunday's presidential race in Peru remains too close to call. It's been an intensely contested election between right-wing candidate Keiko Fujimori and populist opponent Pedro Castillo. The World's Latin America correspondent Jorge Valencia reports from Peru's capital, Lima.
If you walked into these two scenes in downtown Lima early this morning, you might have thought both candidates had won. Former Congresswoman Keiko Fujimori's supporters roared as they checked their cell phones. Early on, Fujimori had a razor-thin lead, according to Peru's National Elections Office.
Ahorita me siento feliz. El Perú ganó.
Fujimori supporter Charlie Peña wore Peru's red, white, and red flag like it was a cape. He said he was happy and that it was Peru that won. Just two blocks away, there was a similar celebration outside of the party headquarters for the teacher-turned-political candidate, Pedro Castillo. People danced as musicians played drums and trumpets. In the middle of the crowd, Sandra Prado waved the Peruvian flag.
Particularmente, yo me siento muy contenta, aunque todavía no está dicho nada.
Prado said she was very glad because she expected Pedro Castillo to come out ahead. She said the results were too narrow.
Muy buenas noches, señores periodistas.
Keiko Fujimori addressed journalists in Lima as Peru's elections office released preliminary results.
Aquí no hay un ganador o un perdedor.
There is no winner and no loser, Fujimori said. We have to strive for the unity of all Peruvians. She called for peace and prudence. About 700 miles away, Pedro Castillo spoke from his rural hometown in the Andean Mountains. Castillo spoke through a megaphone from a balcony as hundreds of supporters watched from below. Castillo told the crowd that their votes had yet to be counted. The race for the new president of Peru was split largely along an urban and rural divide. Fujimori support centered in the capital of Lima, where almost a third of the country's population lives. Castillo support was scattered across the country's vast Amazon and Andean regions, where many voters identify with Castillo, the son of peanut farmers. At Castillo's party headquarters in Lima, Sandra Prado said there is a lot of corruption in Peru. Former President Alberto Fujimori, the father of the candidate Keiko Fujimori, is currently in jail for corruption and human rights abuses. Prado said she supports Castillo because he'll make higher education more accessible to everyone. She's studying accounting and has two children. Meanwhile, Fujimori supporter Charlie Peña is an out-of-work wedding planner and said he has one son. Peña said he wants his son to grow up in a country with freedom and democracy. He said he worries Peru would become a totalitarian regime under Pedro Castillo, whose economic policies have been compared to those of Venezuela. Peña said he doesn't want that in Peru. The new Peruvian president will face massive challenges. The country has the highest death rate and one of the worst economic contractions from the pandemic. And as an election this close shows, Peru continues to be as politically fractured as ever. For The World, I'm Jorge Valencia in Lima, Peru.
We're hearing a lot about missions to Mars these days, much less about our planetary neighbor closer to the sun, Venus. That's going to change because Venus researchers at NASA suddenly have a new workload. NASA is sending not one, but two spacecraft missions to Venus in the coming years. Paul Byrne is a planetary geologist at North Carolina State University. He's also a Venus enthusiast. So there's this thing, Paul, I've heard about in the planetary scientist community called the Venus Curse. We know about the Curse of Bambino here in Boston that ended when the Red Sox won the World Series in 2004. What is the Venus Curse? And is it safe to say it is lifted?
It is lifted, yeah. So basically, it's been 32 years since NASA has sent a spacecraft to visit and explore Venus in particular. For 30-odd years, folks here in the United States have been working really hard to come up with mission concepts to explore Venus. We have dozens of major questions we have yet to answer for that world, yet none of those missions has been picked until now.
Here's how NASA Administrator Bill Nelson described the upcoming missions.
These two sister missions both aim to understand how Venus became an inferno-like world capable of melting lead at the surface.
Right. Well, it is close to the sun. Paul, what are the main goals of these missions? What questions are going to be answered?
So one of the missions, called Veritas, is a radar orbiter. So basically, you cannot see the surface of Venus with visible light. There's a global layer of clouds. You have to use radar to penetrate through that thick cloud and see the surface. And Veritas is going to give us the kinds of resolution of the surface that we've been used to seeing from Mars and the Moon. Veritas will tell us both what the surface actually looks like in 3D, and it's also going to tell us what some of the compositions of the rocks are on the surface, which is something we have virtually no information on. The other mission, Da Vinci Plus, it's going into the atmosphere. So Da Vinci Plus has a small orbiter, but the star of the show is a probe about 3 feet across that's going to drop from the orbiter into the atmosphere. And over the course of an hour, take a bunch of different measurements of the chemistry of the atmosphere, which will tell us over just that 1 hour, remarkable things about 4.5 billion years of Venus's history. And then just as that probe starts to approach the surface, it's going to target a particular part of the surface, a type of terrain that we know almost nothing about, and it's going to photograph them. And in that 1 hour, we are going to take data and have measurements that are going to advance our understanding of Venus in leaps and bounds.
So NASA itself has described Venus as hot, hellish, and unforgiving, but it also has a lot in common with Earth. How will studying Venus help us understand our own planet?
Okay, so basically, if you were an alien astronomer a few tens of light years away with the kind of telescopes and technology we have today, and you look at our solar system, you cannot tell Earth and Venus apart. They're about the same size, they're about the same age, and they're made of about the same stuff. And yet one of them has a surface that's hot enough to melt lead, and the other has trees and squirrels and blue skies. And the thing is, we don't know which of those two outcomes is the one you can expect if you start finding Earth-sized worlds orbiting other stars, which we're starting to do. In fact, we don't even know if the outcome that Venus has is something that went wrong or if something made Earth extraordinarily lucky to give it the outcome it has today. So, you know, the more we do Venus, the more people learn about it and get excited about it. Well, I'm hoping, as a self-professed Venus enthusiast, Venus evangelical, is that we are going to see a new era of exploration focusing on Venus, just like we've had for Mars the last 25 years.
Paul, why and how deep is your interest in Venus? Like, do you make an effort to watch transits of Venus when its orbit passes in front of the sun?
I'm going to make a confession. As a planetary scientist, I actually don't spend that much time looking at stuff through telescopes. I'm spoiled. I look at the images we get from spacecraft. I did my PhD on Mars, and then I worked on NASA's MESSENGER mission for 4 years. That was the first mission to orbit Mercury. I actually didn't really care about Venus. I didn't know much about it. And about 5 years ago, I began to realize all the questions we had about Venus, including the possibility that it might actually have started off like Earth. Yeah. And so I've just fallen in love with that weird, horrible world. And I say this to my friends who study other parts of the solar system. I'm like, look, it's expensive to do Venus. It's expensive to develop the technology to land on the surface, but just because it's expensive and hard, that's not good a reason not to do it.
Mars, look out. Venus is bigger than it appears. Seriously. Paul Byrne, a planetary geologist at North Carolina State University, speaking with us from Raleigh. Thank you very much, Paul.
Thanks, Mark. My pleasure.
It's the world. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Scientists still don't know how this pandemic began, the origins of this novel coronavirus that stopped the planet in its tracks. Theories, but still no conclusions that are 100% certain. And few experts expect a definitive answer to the origins of this outbreak anytime soon. China's lack of transparency is one key reason for all the uncertainty. It's something author Lawrence Wright examines in his newest book, The Plague Year, which is out this week. Lawrence Wright, thanks for being with us.
Thanks, Marco. Good to join you again.
Your look back at the year of the pandemic begins with what at first seems to be a curious reminder of Chairman Mao's famous dip in the Yangtze River in 1966, not long after millions had died during the Great Leap Forward. That's a newsreel with the narrator talking about Mao's various demonstrations of swimming. In 1966, he swam at the widest point on the Yangtze, which happens to be in the city of Wuhan. Now, it seems like a moment in time, but aside from it being in Wuhan, you tie it back to what China went through at the beginning of this pandemic starting December 2019. Explain that.
I think it's important for people who aren't familiar with China to realize what a trauma it has endured, especially through the Mao era. And, you know, the Mao era is still in effect. The Chinese Communist Party still controls that country. Wuhan itself played a particular role. It is where one of the dynasties was overthrown. It's where Mao himself had to flee at one point because of an insurrection in Wuhan. So it's an interesting town, and it's a central place in China. It's like the crossroads Chicago is in the United States.
So you look at the role of one of China's most famous scientists, Xi Xingli of the Wuhan Institute of Virology. She's been called China's Batwoman because of her groundbreaking work on the study of bat coronaviruses. Describe her work at this abandoned copper mine in southern China.
There was a group of miners in 2012, and these particular group, they were supposed to clean up the bat feces, and there were six men. They all fell ill. Three of them died within several months, and the autopsies suggested that it was a SARS-like coronavirus, whereupon Xi Jingli, really one of the most famous scientists in the country, who has done more than any other scientist in the world, perhaps, in terms of cataloging coronaviruses from bats, went down and collected samples from bats. And they found some samples that resemble what causes COVID-19, but aren't exactly the same. And they were taken back to her lab.
So you write, Lawrence Wright, that what happened to those samples of blood, saliva, and fecal matter from that mine are key to understanding how the pandemic arose and what must be done to keep it from happening again. So are you saying there might have been a patient zero at that mine, or are you also saying perhaps that maybe the coronavirus leaked out of that lab from Professor Xi Xingli?
Lab leaks happen with alarming frequency. You know, smallpox leaked out of labs in the UK on three occasions. And CDC and Fort Detrick in the US have had leaks of Ebola and other dangerous diseases. SARS leaked out of labs in China on four separate occasions. So the idea that a lab leak might happen, I think, is totally plausible.
But we don't know. Lawrence, you spoke with many scientists for your research. What is their assessment? How will patient zero in this COVID-19 pandemic ever be found?
Marco, I'm not sure that China will allow enough transparency to set to rest the lab leak theory. There's no evidence that it came out of the animal reservoir. There's suggestive evidence. I mean, coronaviruses have arisen from bats in particular. But we haven't found this virus in a bat or an intermediate animal like a civet cat or a pangolin or something like that. There is suggestive evidence that it could have come from Xi Jinping's lab. Only recently did we learn that three of her researchers were ill enough with COVID-like symptoms in November 2019 to go to the hospital. That's not something that China disclosed. So on both sides, you have highly suggestive evidence, but not proof. And that's where we're stuck. And that's why I believe if we find it in a bat or some intermediate animal, it will set those suspicions to rest.
I'm speaking with author Lawrence Wright, whose book, The Plague Year, is out this week. A few weeks ago, we spoke on the show with David Fidler at the Council on Foreign Relations, and he argued for what he called a global health detente with China, not as appeasement, but because collaboration is key if we hope to stop the next pandemic. Does he have a point, do you think?
Oh, yeah, I totally agree with that. And I also think going further, we need a World Health Organization that actually has some kind of authority. It was upsetting to see how compliant the WHO was with Chinese assessments of this particular outbreak. WHO is a supplicant. It doesn't have any teeth. You know, it depends on its member countries for permission to monitor the health inside those countries. We need a stronger force, one that has the authority to go into a country when there's an outbreak that is not being transparently managed and actually examine what's happening. Suppose SARS-1 had been as contagious. Well, it killed 10% of the people that it infected as opposed to 2%. MERS, the Middle East Respiratory Syndrome, killed 35%. If either of them had been as contagious as this outbreak, the world would be in far more fragile condition.
Finally, Lawrence, you really catalog in your book many instances of the Chinese government's lack of transparency after the initial outbreak, waiting weeks before asserting that there is a human-to-human transmission with COVID-19 costing time and so many lives. You also describe how some Wuhan clinicians got around the government-imposed communications blackout, getting around censors by using emojis or Morse code or Braille, and even Sindarin, the fictional language spoken by elves in the Hobbit books. Explain this, and in a country that is almost defined by opacity, are these the people, and is this the oddly hopeful language of transparency in China going forward?
It's clear that Chinese people understand the system that they live in, and they negotiate to try to get messages out. I mean, the first time SARS-CoV-2 was sequenced, the Chinese suppressed that. And finally, a very courageous dissident scientist posted it on an American genetic studies website. And after that, the Chinese officially posted it, but they went back and closed down the lab of the scientist who had done so and took all of his samples. One of the laws of the new international health regulations is that countries are obliged to share samples of the virus. You need a sample of the virus in order to create a test. And Chinese authorities refused to let at least Americans have a sample of the virus. And we didn't get one until the virus appeared officially in Washington State on January 20th, 3 weeks after the virus had been announced in China. We finally get it from a patient who traveled from China into Washington State, and that's when the starting gun begins for developing a test in the United States. We could have gotten started on it much earlier, but it seems both pointless and heartless that until this day, we have not received a sample of the virus from China.
Will the world have to rely on these creative whistleblowers in the future if another coronavirus emerges from China?
I don't see any alternative until China itself becomes more transparent, if that day comes.
Lawrence Wright's new book is out today. It's called The Plague Year. Lawrence Wright, thank you very much for being with us.
My pleasure.
We'll be right back. You're listening to The World. There's an expression, never let a crisis go to waste. Cities across the globe are rethinking a better designed future post-pandemic.
We're seeing cities like Paris and Milan and Melbourne and also, you know, New York literally pulling up pavement and putting down more bikeways and walkways.
But change, as we all know, is hard. That's still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. In West Africa this weekend, a reminder that extremists are thriving in remote parts of the region. Islamist extremists, it is suspected, killed more than 130 civilians in landlocked Burkina Faso. The massacre occurred near Burkina Faso's eastern border with Niger, an area that has been under threat of violence from ISIS and Al-Qaeda-affiliated groups for several years. For more on this, we turn to Marine Olivesi in Burkina Faso's capital, Ouagadougou. She's with the Norwegian Refugee Council. Marine's also a former reporter with our program. First of all, Marine, tell us what happened this weekend in the village of Solhan. How did this massacre unfold?
Well, from what we heard from testimonies of people who have survived, the attackers came late in the evening and started torching houses, killing people. We don't really have a lot of first-hand testimonies at this point because the people who fled the massacre are in very difficult-to-reach areas. We're trying to assess at this point how many people actually have fled and are in need. About 12 hours after the attack, there were already around 100 families that we knew had fled for safety. That's about roughly 800 people. The actual number has probably climbed a lot higher over the past 2 days.
Do we know at this point who the attackers were? Any claims of responsibility?
No, there has been no claims, and this is quite difficult still to establish at this point.
So it seems the situation in Burkina Faso's Sahel region was kind of peaceful until 2015. What happened over the last 6 years? What changed?
Since 2015, there's been more and more incursions of armed groups coming from northern Mali into Niger and into Burkina Faso. These armed groups would regularly terrorize villages, and progressively these attacks have become more and more recurrent. What is really striking with the latest attack is, of course, the death toll that's unprecedented for a single attack. This kind of attack is precisely what's been driving the displacement in Burkina Faso and thrown the country into a full-blown humanitarian crisis. Just a reminder that there had been a few attacks by that point in Burkina Faso, but 3 years ago, there was virtually no displaced population in the country. We're talking about a country that was still seen as very stable and peaceful. And now, within 3 years, we've gone from virtually zero displaced to 1.2 million people. So that's been a shocking turn, and people here are still trying to wrap their head around it. There's still a clear sense of shock and sometimes slight denial at the scope and scale that this crisis has reached.
Yeah, well, you kind of put the numbers on it. 1.2 million people internally displaced in Burkina Faso. It is really hard to get access to some of the areas where many of these attacks are happening. But a few weeks ago, Maureen, you traveled to the town of Barsalogho, which is one of the places receiving a big influx of displaced people. What did you see? What did you hear there?
Yes, so Barsalogho is a town about 4 hours from the capital, but still quite hard to access. It's been one of the top three cities that has received the most displaced. I was going specifically to look at some of the education program that NRC has put in place there. What's been really striking is the aftermath of such attack, because what's been particular in Burkina Faso is how these attacks often, as I said, target schools. And for them, not only children have been impacted because they make up the bulk of the displaced population, they're about 60% of the displaced population, but because the attacks have been targeting schools, for these children, there's also a sense of schools as being a dangerous place to be, a hotspot to avoid. And that's been striking visiting that particular school there in Barsalogho. It's only offering education to displaced population. And the headmaster told me about one incident that happened time and again in the very few weeks after the school opened this October. But I'll let you hear from him first.
Un élève qui est là, avec le bruit d'un moteur, il prend la porte.
What is the teacher telling you, Maureen?
So the headmaster, Hamado Wedhaogo, he describes how students would be sitting in the classroom, and then all of a sudden there's the sound of a motorbike passing by the school. And just that mere sound of a motorbike would send the students into panic mode, because a lot of times these attacks happen with armed groups barging in on villages with their motorbikes. And so for them, that's a sound associated to imminent attack. And the fact that not only this is happening, but they're also sitting in a school that is possibly a hotspot will send them into panic mode, and they will just rush out of the door. And the headmaster was explaining how at a loss they were, because they wanted to teach these kids, but they were clearly so traumatized that just something like a sound of a motorbike would completely disrupt the classroom and the day. So it's this kind of incident that really show the trauma that these children bear.
This was a pretty horrific massacre over the weekend. What has been the reaction in the capital, Ouagadougou? What are politicians and lawmakers saying?
Well, a period of mourning has been declared. Obviously, there's been a lot of shock. what's clear is there's also been a lot of anxieties that this could be replicated and this could happen again. Over the weekend, we've seen a number of rumors, incidents that haven't really been confirmed, but that shows how difficult, first of all, it is to establish and confirm information. What's striking is we see people that sometimes seek refuge in a specific place, and then that place also comes under attack, and these people come to be displaced a second or third time over again. That's the kind of situation that the country has been settling into, and that, of course, raises a lot of questions. If there's an end in sight, there was a sense that maybe there was a period of accalmie that had been reached over the past few months because there were fewer incidents like that. But then we've seen just the past few weeks a flare-up of violence again, and the Solan attack has been the biggest yet.
Marine Olivesi with the Norwegian Refugee Council speaking with us from Ouagadougou about this weekend's violence in Burkina Faso. Marine, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Marco.
When Joe Biden was running for president, he said there'd be no more blank checks for Trump's favorite dictator. Biden was referring to Egyptian President Abdel Fattah al-Sisi. Now Biden is president, and some human rights activists say the blank checks are still going to Cairo. Fact is, the Biden administration's defense budget to Congress allotted the same military aid to Egypt as the Trump administration, despite a still dismal record of human rights. The World's Rupa Shenoy reports.
Egypt has an estimated 60,000 political prisoners, including activists, lawyers, and academics. Among them are five Egyptian Americans and family members of five people in the U.S. who've spoken out about human rights in Egypt. Last month, the D.C.-based advocacy group The Freedom Initiative released a report about those imprisonments. Allison McManus is the initiative's research director.
These are clear efforts on the part of the Egyptian government to curtail rights and freedoms in the United States.
U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken cited the Freedom Initiative's report when he was in Cairo last month, meeting with Egyptian President Sisi. Here he is in a press conference.
I certainly raised this in my meeting today and will continue to do so until Americans are reunited with their families. More broadly, President Biden takes the issue of human rights and our commitment to human rights very seriously. Indeed, he's asked us to put it at the heart of our foreign policy, and that's exactly what we're doing, and that was reflected in the conversations that we had today.
McManus says many in the U.S. hoped that that meeting would result in the release of their imprisoned family members.
We celebrated the attention that was given to the issue, but we can't really celebrate until we see more releases.
Meanwhile, Egypt earned the Biden administration's gratitude for its help during the recent violence between Israel and Palestinians, something Blinken mentioned at the same press conference.
Egypt played a crucial role in brokering the ceasefire. It's already committed $500 million to the reconstruction effort in Gaza.
Egypt has been a key ally of the U.S., and the Biden administration is already indicating it'll take a nuanced approach to the relationship. In February, it approved a $197 million sale of missiles to Egypt. That was disappointing for human rights activists. Seth Binder is director of advocacy at the Project on Middle East Democracy.
That was an opportunity for the U.S. government to say, no, we are making a change. We're not just going to continue business as usual and move forward with an arms sale. We're going to need to see legitimate progress on human rights reforms. And they didn't do that. And that was sort of the first big signal.
The second big signal was in Biden's just-released budget proposal for the Defense Department. Groups, including Amnesty International, had urged the administration to make military aid for Egypt contingent on an improvement in human rights. But that's not what the Biden administration chose to do. Binder says its proposed budget makes the same request for Egypt that's been made since 1987— $1.3 billion in military aid with no restrictions.
So to me, this is policy on autopilot, on cruise control.
Other experts believe that making military aid contingent on human rights improvements will have the wrong effect, for instance, pushing Egypt into the arms of countries like Russia. And earlier this year, Egypt did defy the U.S. by buying Russian jets. Advocates pushing for a harsher stance toward Egypt now have their hopes centered on the U.S. Congress, where the budget goes next for a review. And Congress has already shown a willingness to act. Last year, it made a portion of aid to Egypt conditioned on the release of political prisoners. Blinken can waive human rights conditions placed on aid in the interest of national security. Binder hopes Congress takes that power away.
I'd like to see them remove the national security waiver entirely to send the strong message that Congress does care about human rights in Egypt and is unwilling to sit back and wait anymore.
Allison McManus of the Freedom Initiative agrees. She acknowledges the argument that military aid to Egypt buys the U.S. leverage to ask for change there. But McManus says she doesn't see that leverage being used.
I think what we're seeing is a desire to return to business as usual, where the administration will insist on human rights behind closed doors, where they'll continue to really insist that they are prioritizing issues like political detentions, like freedom of expression and freedom of association. But when push comes to shove, we don't actually see firm policy changes.
Whatever the Biden administration's approach, thousands of families are hoping it will somehow result in the release of wrongly imprisoned Egyptians and Egyptian Americans in Egypt. For The World, I'm Rupa Shenoy.
If you're a coffee maven, perhaps you know about a new brand from Colombia that is now available in the U.S. With the name Deportado, this is not a coffee that evokes the lush highlands of the Andes. Deportado aims to make a political statement about immigration reform. From the Colombian city of Cali, Manuel Rueda has that story.
Since he was deported to Colombia, Mauricio Zúñiga has been learning a lot about coffee. At a lab near Cali, he joins two women in white robes, who are professional tasters. Zúñiga slurps a spoonful of freshly brewed coffee and swirls it in his mouth for a few seconds before spitting it back out. These tasting sessions help him to come up with ideas for the blends that he now makes in Colombia and exports to the United States.
Our primary blend is with a specialty coffee called Sudan Rumé. And we're looking right now at a couple with another variety called Laurina and another variety called Geisha.
At the age of 62, Zúñiga has been forced to reinvent himself. With the help of family and friends, he set up a coffee brand called Deportado, which is Spanish for deported.
In our minds, we had the idea that this was going to create awareness about the issues of deportation and the unfairness of the system that was taking people like myself out of the country instead of actually resolving the issues within the country.
Zúñiga's immigration nightmare started on Halloween of 2018, when ICE agents carrying guns and badges arrived at his office in Miami.
So on October 31st of 2018, they came to my job and they basically arrested me in front of my wife and employees, my daughter.
At the time, Zúñiga owned a company that refurbished clinical beds for some of the biggest hospitals in South Florida. His wife, Roxanne, who was born in the United States, watched in astonishment.
The whole thing was just very traumatic and very difficult. I mean, I had to turn around and face all of our employees and try to explain to them what was going on.
The business, which had 10 employees, quickly began to fall apart.
That happened on a Wednesday, and on Friday, half of the guys quit. That was like, they were like, ay, Señora Roxana, yo me voy. What was I going to say? I mean, you know, what do you do?
Zúñiga's deportation stems from a banking crime he confessed to back in 1998. He did some months in jail for that, but he was working and living in the U.S. legally and applying for permanent status. Still, a judge refused to extend his visa.
No matter what we did and explained the zero tolerance policies that were enacted during the Trump administration, just basically said, that's it.
Zúñiga had worked as an informant for the DEA in the late 90s and early 2000s as part of a deal to reduce his sentence for banking fraud. He helped agents to identify businessmen laundering money for drug cartels, but that didn't stop his deportation. Instead, he was flown to Colombia and had to start thinking about what to do next.
I mean, I tried to do more of the medical stuff, but it was a very closed environment to that. So I did what I did best. You know, I mean, I speak both languages, so I did translations for quite some time and got paid for that.
His wife, Roxanne, managed to sell off their company's assets and joined him in Colombia. During a visit to a friend's coffee farm, the couple realized that they could build a new business.
The idea came from a good friend of mine. Like I said, here in this farm that we're were looking at, we came in and said, hey, you know, why don't you look at doing something like this? You know, we had friends in the business, and gradually we visited the farms. Gradually we learned more about coffee.
In April of this year, Deportado exported its first batch of ground coffee to the United States. The company makes three blends that are named Amnesty, La Sombra, or The Shadow, and La Fuerza, which means strength. Zuniga says that his daughters Julia and Alina came up with the names. Julia, an art teacher in Colorado, says that at first the family had doubts about making the brand so political, but eventually everybody warmed up to the Deportado name.
But the reality is that this is happening not just to people in the United States, it's happening to people around the world from all different types of backgrounds. And I think it's something that needs to be spoken about. So many conversations are had over cups of coffee. And why not something as important as this one?
For every bag it sells, Deportado donates $1 to Families Belong Together, a group that helps immigrants going through deportation proceedings.
We understand that we have been very privileged during this time to have access to resources. And we also acknowledge that there are people that are going through the same thing that don't have the resources that we did.
Zuniga says that the coffee brand has given him something positive to do while he tries to get a new visa to return to the United States. But setting up this business hasn't been easy. He's been battling a prostate cancer that resurfaced after he was deported. And the recent protests and roadblocks in Colombia have slowed down his plans to export more coffee. Still, the 62-year-old says that all of this makes him more resilient and has taught him that it's never too late to get a fresh start.
And I tell my daughters always that Colonel Sanders created Kentucky Fried Chicken when he was 66 years old. You know, so, you know, we still have four more years.
Zuniga plans to spend the time expanding the business and is hoping to reunite with his family in the United States. For The World, I'm Manuel Rueda in Cali, Colombia.
Did you know that there were 8 Chinese passengers on the Titanic and 6 of them actually survived? Their tale had never been told until a documentary got produced called The Six. At theworld.org, you can find our story about that and others you might have missed in the last week. Again, that's at theworld.org. A verdict from the U.S. Supreme Court today. Thousands of people in the U.S. living under temporary protected status, TPS, cannot apply to become permanent residents. The ruling impacts people who fled war or a natural disaster but entered the U.S. illegally. Oscar Chacon joins me now to help us understand the wider implications of this announcement. He's the executive director of Alianza Americas, a national immigrant rights group. Oscar, you've been closely following this case that made it to the Supreme Court. What is the court saying?
Well, essentially, what the court is clarifying is the idea that somebody who came into the U.S. without inspection, without permission, and who then benefit from temporary protected status and receive temporary protected status, and there is a visa that you can potentially get, you will not be able to access it unless you go out of the country to be able to finalize that particular process.
What was the argument from the other side? I mean, isn't TPS, temporary protected status, a form of a visa?
Well, not exactly, you know, because it is a program enacted due to laws that were passed back in 1990. But what several circuit courts in the U.S. had decided were basically contradictory decisions. Some courts had decided that having received TPS constituted admission into the U.S., and therefore you would qualify for adjustment of status just the way I described it before, while other circuit courts said no. If you only obtained TPS but you did not enter the country originally with a visa, getting TPS does not actually add up to legal admission, and that's exactly the disagreement that the Supreme Court now has settled.
So a lot of people have been in the U.S. for many years under TPS status. What can they do now if they can't apply for a green card?
Well, there are two things that we absolutely need to do. We need to educate people so that people understand who are going to be affected by the decision made today. But at the same time, we need to double down on our efforts to actually get the actual U.S. immigration law changed, and change in a very minor way, in a way that essentially acknowledges that anybody who has been here for many years should not really be put through the burden of having to go out of the country and face whatever consequences that may bring. Particularly, we need to work hard to eliminate something known as the 3- and 10-year bar that were enacted in the 1996 immigration law that is very well known to be a highly punitive immigration policy, which is the policy that remains in place today.
Oscar Chacon is the executive director of Alianza Americas. Oscar, thanks very much for your time.
My pleasure. Thank you.
As the planet starts to look past this year plus of hardship, cities everywhere are coming up with plans to reopen and imagining a post-pandemic future, one that's not simply a return to the way things were. The world's Bianca Hillier takes a look at what's being prioritized around the globe.
Design innovation after a major event like a war or a pandemic has been done before. The bubonic plague led to less cramped living quarters in Europe. And after the 1918 pandemic, easy-to-clean materials like glass and steel were in high demand. Experts say history is about to repeat itself.
I think most cities around the world are going to be affected, but they're going to be affected in very different ways.
Robert Mugga is the co-founder of the Igarapé Institute, a think tank in Rio de Janeiro. He specializes in cities, security, and new technologies. And he says one change that many cities are planning for is more green spaces in urban areas.
We're seeing cities like Paris, Milan, and Melbourne, and Amsterdam, and Bristol, and also New York, and San Francisco, and elsewhere, literally pulling up pavement and putting down more bikeways and walkways and greener spaces.
Of course, some people left cities altogether over the past year. Office vacancies are at a 30-year high in New York City alone. The City of London is dealing with the same reality. They're converting empty cubicles into more than 1,500 residential units. Street space is also being reimagined across the globe. Bike lanes are becoming more common, but with an influx of delivery services, cities like Toronto and Seattle are creating dedicated curb space for delivery drivers. Over in Paris, getting around fast is a major goal. Mayor Anne Hidalgo has long been advocating for a 15-minute city. Carlos Moreno advises her on the project.
This crisis shows that we need to live differently.
On a bit of a scratchy phone line, Moreno told me that residents of the French capital should be able to do everything they need to do without walking or biking more than 15 minutes from home. That includes work, school, shopping, doctor's appointments, concerts, everything. He explained more in a TED Talk.
Urban life is vibrant and creative, but we need to make urban life more pleasant, agile, healthy, and flexible. To do so, we need to make sure everyone, and I mean everyone, those living downtown and those living at the fringes, has access to all key services within proximity.
Other cities entered 2020 already well-designed for a pandemic. Singapore's relatively small footprint has been praised for using each square meter exceptionally well. The island city-state is framed by lush greenery and has world-renowned public infrastructure. But even they have changes to make.
We really are talking of the new normal.
Chan Heng Chi is the chair of the Lee Kuan Yew Center for Innovative Cities in Singapore. She says the city-state is focusing on how to integrate public health measures into everyday life.
We will emphasize a lot of testing, tracing, and extensive vaccination. And for the foreseeable future in events, you know, in the workplace, in schools, you go to a conference, you go to a concert, you go to a game, there'll be testing throughout.
Chan expects some aspects of daily life to revert back to normal. For example, she suspects that in time, people will return to the office and slip back into their pre-pandemic routines.
It is very hard to change human behavior. You know, it's harder than you think. We yearn to go back to the normal.
Still, this is an opportunity to create a new normal. The UN projects that 80% of the world's population will be living in cities by the end of the century. Robert Mugga says this is an unmatched urban moment.
I really do think that cities have this game-changing potential, and many of the cities that have yet to be built will have a huge influence on our future prosperity, well-being, and happiness. But we really have to design them right.
For that reason, Mugga says, This conversation about the future of cities is more urgently needed now than ever. For the world, I'm Bianca Hillier.
Here's to better cities and to better days ahead. Hey, it's Monday. This week, anyway, it's all downhill from here. The World comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH in Boston. Be safe, stay strong. We'll see you again tomorrow.